This is Vital Conversations, the podcast with Dr. Lars Gunnar.
Dr. Sean Baker, welcome to the show.
Yeah, man. Hey, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
You're a medical doctor, more specifically an orthosurgeon, veteran, author, carnivore athlete, which we're going to talk about a lot because I think people have a lot of questions about that. And you're the CEO of MeetRx. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you kind of got into this position that you're in right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm in a position I never, ever in a million years would have envisioned myself to be, you know, growing up, deciding early on I wanted to be a physician. I never thought I'd be some diet book author and leading this crazy group of people eating a weird diet. I mean, that was never part of the plan. You know, it's kind of funny how it kind of came to that way. You know, as you pointed out, you know, obviously I had my traditional medical training, you know, was spent many years as a surgeon, you know, doing, you know, just the typical surgeon stuff, you know, as an orthopedic guy, replacing hips and knees and doing trauma cases and fixing, you know, sports injuries and that stuff. And, you know, I think somewhere in there, I mean, selfishly, the only thing that got me to change my approach towards the way I treated people was my own health. I mean, it was, you know, because you didn't know. I mean, and as I got into my, I guess, early 40s, I started to see deterioration in my health and my quality of life. You know, despite the fact that I was training like a maniac as an athlete, I was still managing to be a very highly competitive athlete, you know, throughout my life, including through my medical career. And, you know, once I started seeing my own health decline, and I was like, I can't train any harder. I mean, I'm already maxed out on that lever. I started really to look into diet. I mean, diet before too had been just, you know, get plenty of protein, you know, and minimize the junk food. And that was my kind of strategy. And it worked until it stopped working, which was about age 42 for me. And it probably stopped working before that, but I didn't sort of realize it. In retrospect, I probably starting to get sick metabolically, probably in my late 20s, but I didn't really come to enough of a head where I couldn't compensate with sports until I was probably, like I said, early 40s. And so at that point, you know, I just started looking into nutrition and pulling those levers and, you know, went through a whole different range of different dietary patterns and strategies. And some were more effective than others. Some were effective, but horrible and non-sustainable. Like I will point to the low fat, high vegetable, you know, almost vegetarian approach, which was effective. It helped me lose weight and lean out, but it was just, I was just absolutely miserable on it. I was just, you know, wasn't a very happy person and no one wanted to be around me. Yeah, the nurses would say, we like the fat Dr. Baker health a lot better than who looks better, but, you know, kind of an ass. And so, and I felt like that too. So I made the transition over time and ended up, you know, about, I guess, 5-6 years ago, starting looking at a meat-based diet. And, you know, I kind of pulled the trigger just about 5 years ago on it and kind of went full time, you know, as an experiment, you know, to, you know, see what a, you know, 100% meat-based diet would do to me. And surprisingly, it was tremendous. I saw tremendous benefits. And so I decided I would do it for 30 days. And, you know, when the 30 days was up, I went back to my more sort of omnivorous diet with fruits and vegetables back in. And I immediately didn't feel as good. And I was like, well, you know, I've already sort of in my mind resolved that meat wasn't bad for me. So I had no problem saying, well, I'd rather just eat meat and feel good. And that's kind of my, you know, my approach ever since then is, you know, kind of do what works for you and do what's going to give you the best result, you know, cause I, you know, when you look at the literature on nutrition, I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, you can make any argument you want, you know, you can pull out data and you can cherry pick any diet and say, this is the best diet and you can find literature that's going to support it. But at the end of the day, you got to look in the mirror, you know, both figuratively and literally. And if you look in the mirror and you're not getting what you want, then, you know, either you're not doing something right or you're just, you know, your standards are too high or whatever. But, so that's been my guiding principle ever then, is do what works and be objective about it. And so, so for me, it's a meat-based diet. For, you know, really literally tens upon tens of thousands of people now, they found the same thing. I think, you know, there's some rationale, you know, sense-wise from when we look at, you know, who humans are and where we came from, meat was always part of that equation. I mean, I know there's some people who are trying to write revisionist history and saying we were, you know, we only ate meat because we were starving. And I'm like, well, if that were true, why didn't we stop eating meat when agriculture was invented or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's just some, you know, utter nonsense. I mean, all the, you know, the anthropologic and archaeologic evidence points to huge meat consumption among humans. And I think that's our primary, state with the capacity to eat other stuff if we need to. But I don't think I think meat is just better nutrition. And I like the fact that if I eat a lot of meat, I get a lot of good nutrition and a lot of good things happen. If I don't eat the garbage, I think the biggest problem is we conflate meat eating with the standard American diet. And the standard American diet is clearly, it's a plant-based diet. I mean, 70% of the Americans' calories come from plants. You know, unfortunately, most of that is processed garbage. I mean, it's refined grains and carbohydrates and sugars and vegetable oils. I mean, that is the American diet. To blame it on meat is kind of strains credibility. I mean, you've got the average American eating something like 2 ounces of beef a day, 2 ounces. And, you know, you're going to say that little 2 ounces of beef is somehow responsible for all of the chronic disease that we see. And, you know, clearly, I mean, and many people don't realize this, back in the 1970s, before we had the obesity epidemic, Americans were eating something like 40% more red meat than we eat today. It was the average American was eating something like 90 pounds a year. Now we eat something like 55, 56 pounds a year. So red meat consumption has dramatically decreased, and yet obesity, heart disease, diabetes, you know, chronic disease, autoimmune disease, inflammatory disease, so on and so forth, has risen. You know, that's just an observation. It doesn't necessarily point to causation or lack of causation, but it's very curious to look at that and try and make the argument that, hey, yeah, it's got to be the meat. It's got to be the meat, which has been decreasing in our diet. And it can't possibly be all the processed food, which has been increasing in our diet, you know. It's almost comical that people can't see that, but that's what it is. It's a lot of marketing that we, unfortunately, even some of the science is really marketing. You know, some of the nutrition science is basically marketing dressed up with a scientific paper attached to it. But that's
what's been wild to me, is that they are saying that we need to eat the food pyramid or the plate. And when you actually look at the shopping data and what people are actually buying, we are eating that as a whole, eating what they are telling us to eat, and everyone is fatter and sicker than ever, which is very interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, we have definitely, I mean, there's data that show that we have made some of the adjustments that have been recommended with regard to, particularly with regard to decreasing fat consumption, with regard to, upping grain consumption. That has clearly happened, and the results have not been good. Now, to be fair, I mean, people are eating more processed junk food, and I mean, that to me is probably the biggest problem we face. You know, whether you subscribe to a carnivore-based ketogenic, you know, paleo diet, or you subscribe to a vegan or vegetarian diet. I mean, clearly the common enemy is this processed, you know, just garbage. And unfortunately, the powers that be are trying to push us even more in that direction of more processed factory-made food. And it's really shameful to see that.
I'm finding that people get really conflicted when you tell them to eat an animal-based diet. They get really confused. They almost can't wrap their head, like, vegetables, right? Like fruit, right? And so can you just tell people what an animal-based diet really does look like? Like, what does a day of food look like? It doesn't need to be monotonous. So give people like a bigger picture of what this could be on the whole.
Yeah. I mean, well, when people ask me, and when I do presentations on this diet, I say, focus on animal sourced food as your source of nutrition. You know, plants can either be limited or eliminated as necessary. And some people don't need to fully eliminate them. Some people do. And the goal, again, you know, our goal at the end of the day is to optimize or improve health. And so that's the guiding principle. It's not, you know, you have to eat X, Y, and Z exactly in this order and this amount. I mean, it can, you know, there's a lot of different animal-based foods, seafood, shellfish, you know, chicken, pork, beef, lamb, goat, you know, elk, deer, you know, polar bear, you know, whatever, squid, scorpion, you know, whatever you want to eat. I mean, eggs cooked however you want. You know, some people will add some seasoning and spices to make it exciting. Some people include dairy in there. Dairy is one of these ones where some people struggle, some people do well with. So there's lots of ways you can do it. And, you know, and there's some people, you know, like I said, within this community, and I've been, for good or bad, I've been kind of at the forefront of this animal-based carnivore movement for the last, you know, half decade or more. And I've had the opportunity to interact with literally thousands upon thousands of people. And I mean, what I see consistently is, you know, there's a certain percentage of people that are just 100%. They only eat, you know, it's just like beef and water every day. And they're happy with that. And they're fine. More power to them. And I'm fully happy to support them. But more realistically, what I see is there's people that they go in phases where they're 100% animal based for 3 or 4 months, and then they kind of drift off, and then they end up, you know, and so at the end of the day, with all things combined, they probably somewhere 90-95%, you know, they, you know, 90% steak and eggs and seafood and, you know, a little bit of cheese, and 5% might be blueberries and, you know, sweet potato here and there, a piece of dark chocolate occasionally, and they're doing fine. They're doing great. And I'm like, more power to you. If that makes it sustainable to you, that's fine. But I think the goal, really, the animal base, is to focus on the best source of nutrition we have. Animal products, hands down, are better. They're better than plant products for just about every nutrient out there, you know, as far as bioavailability, as far as lack of anti-nutrients, which compete and, you know, block the absorption of nutrients with regard to ease of digestion. You know, one of the problems is a lot of people have gut issues. I mean, irritable bowel syndrome is incredibly, incredibly common in the United States. And I think, again, that's probably secondary to this hyper-processed, you know, garbage diet we have. It destroys people's guts, and it makes it very difficult to process food that otherwise might not be problematic. And so then the answer is always just shove more fiber in there. And then that, for many people, it just messes it up and makes it worse. And so we kind of, you know, it's kind of an elimination diet for many people. It solves problems. It's easy to digest, but the nutrition, I don't think you can, I mean, people will make the argument, but I don't think it's a valid argument to say that you get more, you know, quote unquote, healthy nutrition from fruits and vegetables when you don't. It's not that there's no nutrition in there, but it's less efficient, clearly. You know, the phytonutrients that we talk about, what people like to talk about, there's actually phytonutrients in meat. Most people don't realize that. I mean, there's some great work coming out of Duke University. Fred Provenzis, Stefan von Vliet have shown that, you know, the beef takes on the profile of what the animal is eating. And so some of these phytonutrients from all the varied plants that these animals are consuming shows up in the meat. And so we get them anyway, indirectly. And so whether you're, you know, concerned about some sort of relatively obscure phytonutrient, a cow has a more varied diet when it comes to plants than you and I do typically. I mean, or particularly a wild roaming animal, because they can eat plants that we can't. I mean, I can't go out in the field and graze on weeds and flowers and forbs and grasses and brushes. They do. And those have such a wide variety of phytonutrients that the cow ingests, it ends up in its tissues and its fats and its you know, muscle. And we get some of that indirectly. Whereas if I were to sit there and try to consume those directly from plants, I'd probably get sick, and two, I might even die. And so it's actually, you know, the arguments that are made about that are, you know, you can very easily provide these counter arguments. And again, at the end of the day, it's not about arguments, it's about results. And that's why I said, if you can't look in the mirror and say, hey, what I'm working is, you know, working, because I can construct an argument for any diet with medical literature. I mean, I can literally find an article that will support any diet you want to make. There's a Twinkie diet, right? You can make an argument for a Twinkie diet. It's a guy that did a study on that, right? You can make those arguments, but at the end of the day, you know, you got to look in the mirror, and you got to look in it both figuratively and literally. And, you know, if you don't get the result you want, then, you know, you're not doing the right thing.
Time for a change. One of the things that pops up over and over again, and you touched on it a little bit, is the fiber. People cannot wrap their head around not having fiber in the diet. Can we talk about that? Like, what have you found as far as like reducing fiber, eliminating fiber? What kind of implications does fiber actually have on health?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a number of associational studies that show fiber. People that eat more fiber tend to be healthier. They have better health outcomes. They have less cardiovascular disease, less cancer. You know, back in the 1930s, Dennis Burkitt was in Africa observing that these Africans did not have chronic disease like the Europeans or the other folks in England did. And he noted they ate a lot of fiber. And so this is sort of the beginning of the fiber hypothesis. And so we've sort of, you know, and then we've got this sort of dietary, U.S. dietary historical sort of vegetarian sort of religious undertones that started with the American Dietetics Association in 1917, founded by largely Seventh-day Adventists who were very much into a plant-based, you know, fiber-based, you know, Garden of Eden type of diets. And so that's kind of been underlying all of our dietary things for years. But, you know, when you look at the actual intervention trials with either fiber supplementation or fibrous foods, the effects are not that particularly convincing. You know, again, when we're looking at RCTs, interventional trials, there's a few that show a little bit decreased cholesterol. There's some that show that, you know, fiber, like for instance, if you're eating drinking apple juice versus eating an apple, you know, and you know, they've done studies where they control how fast it's absorbed and you eat the apple or you drink it very slowly, like you'd eat an apple. And it shows that fiber does mitigate some of these glucose excursions. And, you know, there's been studies looking at, satiety. It does seem to be, it does seem to provide some satiety. It does seem to, I mean, there's been a study looking at blood pressure. It doesn't seem to make much of a difference in blood pressure. It's like 1 or 2 points on your systolic, which is clinically meaningless. But there's, you know, there's a lot of marketing that goes behind fiber because fiber, quite honestly, is cheap. I mean, it's cheap, you know, like the cereal companies. I mean, they produced cereal, which was basically based on agricultural waste products. And they found that they fortified it with, you know, they crush it into pulp and they grind it up and they fortify it with some iron and they put some sugar on it. Called a healthy food, people would eat that. It's a good way to make a lot of profits. It's very profitable. You know, something like some foods are 10% sawdust, which is, you know, methyl cellulose. And you see, there's just hundreds of products on the market which are basically sawdust, which is, you know, incredibly cheap, right? So this is a cheap product. There's a lot of marketing behind that, but there is some. To be fair, there's some associational data that shows that fiber is conditionally beneficial. I think the issue with that is, you know, if you're eating something like fruits and vegetables, particularly vegetables that are high in fiber, some of those calories are replacing junk food. And so you're just by virtue excluding other foods. Additionally, we also know that higher fiber consumption is associated with wealth. And again, wealthy people tend to fare better in almost every single, you know, health outcome population study. It's always the people that are socioeconomically disadvantaged, which are going to have a worse outcome. So fiber consumption is a proxy for wealth in many cases. And so same thing with eating grass-finished meat. You know, wealthy people eat grass-finished meat. Is that a fair comparison? You know, when you're comparing poor people versus rich people, it really isn't. But, you know, some of the mechanistic stuff they talk about, you know, this, one of the things that's talked about lately, you know, well, gut function. You know, if you don't eat a lot of fiber, if you eat a lot of fiber, you're going to have larger bowel movements. You're going to have more frequent bowel movements. And the belief is that is, for some reason, healthier. I think it goes back to, I don't know, 16th century France, where there was, I think it was Sava means, how are you going, which means, how are you crapping? You know, how's your bowel moving? And then that was conflated, you know, that was thought to mean, you know, if your bowels are moving frequently, then you're healthy. And this is some of this old superstitious stuff. When really the medical, you know, literature does not really support a particular frequency of bowel movement, you know, once a day, twice a day, once every 3 days, once every 4 days, once a week, all those are considered within the realm of normal human bowel function. More important is something called a Bristol stool scar, where you're looking at the consistency, not to get gross, but there's, you know, liquid diarrhea on one side and there's rock hard pellets on the other side. Somewhere in the middle is where you want to be typically. And so, but the fiber, you know, one of the things that most often is talked about these days is the effect of the fiber on the gut microbiome. So the concern is, when I'm eating fiber, there's bacteria in my gut that will eat that. They eat the fiber. We can't. They eat it, and they will elicit, you know, a small amount of short chain fatty acids. You know, I think the humans can. I mean, you can make about 200 calories a day that way. This is, you know, this is somewhere, you know, as opposed to like a gorilla or a horse or a cow, where the majority of their diet, their caloric intake, is coming from these short chain fatty acids from these giant fermentation vats that gorillas have or cows have, you know, called a rumen in a cow and a big hindgut, cecum and colon in a gorilla. We don't have much capacity to do that. But the thought is that these short chain fatty acids, particularly butyrate and butyric acid, has a uniquely protective effect on the colonic, the health of the colon cells, the colonocytes or the mucosa. And, you know, there's, you know, some scientific evidence to suggest that that's true. However, that's not the only way by which you can produce butyrate or short chain fatty acids. In fact, protein absorption or protein digestion also produces short chain fatty acids, methyl butyrate and propionate acetate and many other short chain fatty acids. But just as importantly, if you're familiar with ketogenic diets or ketosis, one of the primary ketone bodies is beta hydroxybutyrate, which circulates in the bloodstream, and the colonocytes have access to that too. I mean, they're part of the bloodstream. They're vascularized, and so what we know is beta hydroxybutyrate very rapidly associates and reversely associates into butyrate. You know, and so it's a reverse reaction. It's just a hydroxyl group, and so that happens very effectively. And some of the thought is that butyrate that's being made by the microbiome actually is being converted to beta hydroxybutyrate, and that is the active ingredient that's helping the colonocytes. So, by going on a lower carb diet, you're generally increasing the beta-hydroxybutyrate content in your blood, whether you're in ketosis or not. Even if you're at sub-nutritional ketosis thresholds, you're still circulating more butyrate. And so these cells are healthy. Additionally, you know, this is interesting, I've seen some stool sample reports on people that have tested stool, you know, butyrate levels and other short-chain fatty acids on people on a carnivore diet. Guess what? Butyrate levels are completely normal. So they're getting it from somewhere. So, I mean, it's this requirement that you must have fiber. I mean, there's a number of studies out there looking at fiber constipation, for instance, chronic constipation. There was a nice study, I think, done 2014 looking at, you know, a case series of, you know, I don't know how many patients they had, 100 patients or something like that. And they, you know, they looked at, you know, normal fiber, high fiber amounts, low fiber, you know, middle, low, and zero fiber amounts with regard to constipation. The only group that had complete resolution of those symptoms were the zero fiber group. You know, if you have Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, they'll often put you on a low residue diet, which is a low fiber diet. And so, there's another study, there's a really nice study looking at that Ann Peary did, and I think maybe it was 2013. In a journal, and I think it was a gastroenterology journal, looking at colonoscopies on people that were eating various amounts of fiber and looking at diverticulosis, which is a disease of the colon where you get these pouches that pooch out that later get filled with, you know, waste material and become infected, leading to diverticulitis. But diverticulosis precedes that, and that is considered a pathological condition of the colon. And in her study of, I think it was 2,000 or so people, the people that ate the most fiber, that had the most bowel movements, had the most disease. And the people that ate the least fiber, had the least bowel movements, had the least disease. And so, you know, I think there, you know, the essentiality of fiber, clearly that's not the case. I mean, I literally have not had effectively almost zero fiber in almost 5 years. And I'm not dead. I mean, so you can't say essential, right? I'm not dead. I mean, you know, some people think I'm brain dead or stupid or whatever, but I mean, I'm clearly functioning as a human being. I'm doing athletic things. I'm exhibiting what I think is pretty good health, as are thousands and thousands and thousands of other people like me now that have done that. So, I mean, the essentiality argument, you can't make that argument. Now, some people say it's nuanced and it's conditionally beneficial and therefore it should be consumed. And again, I think it's context dependent. I think if you're eating a standard American junk food diet, probably eating more fiber is going to be good for you. I don't think it's essential. I think I think for some people it's detrimental, particularly people with GI issues. You know, people, like I said, irritable bowel syndrome often responds well. I mean, some of the best results I've seen on this carnivore diet are people with gut issues, whether it's Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, you know, the so-called inflammatory bowel diseases, or IBS or other issues, or reflux or GERD or whatever. Reducing fiber seems to help tremendously.
And that's so funny that you said, because I've noticed the exact same thing, seeing patients the last 6 years, advising them to literally eat more red meat, do more of a keto, let's change the pattern because what you're doing isn't working. And people will say, half their doctors say reduce their fiber, half their doctors say increase your fiber to get a better gut health. And so it seems like even the doctors don't really read the literature. They're completely divided in this, or maybe it's just they honestly don't know and they're guessing. That's what's been interesting. What you mentioned, like, anthropological data, and that's one thing I do want to touch on as well. It's like we grew strong bones, big muscles, big brains from eating animal meats. Like, what can we cover that? What have you discovered with that?
Yeah, I mean, and there's Mickey Bendore just published a study this year, I think earlier, you know, I think in February this year, looking at, the evidence for, human diet, and how we evolved, and one of the reasons we became Homo sapiens. But if we go back, if we want to call human, if the scientific definition of human is Homo anything, Homo erectus, Homo sapien, Homo heidelbergensis, Homo habilis, and so on and so forth. This one, human, supposedly started. And so if we look at humans, particularly starting, say, with Homo erectus, which, you know, was the most successful human species ever. Homo erectus lasted for 1.8 million years. And, you know, Homo sapiens have been around arguably 300,000, maybe 400,000 at the outset. So Homo erectus was clearly one of their defining characteristics was their ability to hunt, and particularly how effective they were at hunting large mega herbivores, you know, these big giant animals like elephants, mastodons, and mammoths and so on and so forth. And so they grew a significant brain due to that. You know, they started out with a relatively small, you know, 600-700 cc brain, and they progressed up to, I think in some cases, up to as high as 1100 cc's, which is almost what Homo sapiens are today. You know, the evidence, you know, the fossil evidence of hunting is clear. I mean, you know, you any of these cave paintings we're all aware of, you know, these cave paintings in Lascaux, France, and other places show clearly animals on the wall with people hunting them. So we know we clearly did that. Michael Richards from Max Planck University has done a number of studies looking at stable radioisotopes. And they'll look at carbon isotopes and nitrogen isotopes, and they can tell by, you know, what those percentages are, what that person was eating by looking at the bones, and they can tell what, you know, what they were eating and what, you know, what animals were eating, what the animals were eating, where them were eating, and they can look at it, they can determine trophic levels, you know. And, you know, all the data, particularly coming out of Europe and some of the other places they've looked at, have consistently shown humans were highly, highly carnivorous. They were, you know, their isotope data looked very similar to wolves. In fact, more carnivorous than wolves. In fact, they were eating some of the wolves. And so humans, you know, whether they're Neanderthal or Homo sapien, clearly were consuming a lot of meat. You know, some of the evolutionary physiologic adaptations, the incredibly acidic gut we have, the gut environment, the very very effective small intestine. You know, most of our digestion is occurring and absorption is occurring in our small intestine, contrasting it to, like as I alluded to earlier, other primates, chimpanzees and other great apes, where much of their caloric intake is being fermented in their hindgut. You know, if for instance, you know, I'm a, you know, 240, 250 pound man. I'm not much different than the average silverback gorilla, which is, you know, maybe 300 pounds. You know, a big one would be 300 pounds. I eat, you know, about 4 pounds of food a day. You know, that's what sustains me. An equivalent size gorilla is eating somewhere between 30 and 50 pounds of food a day, plant material. So the efficiency level is tremendously different. And because they are eating so much, I mean, they literally spend 80% of their waking hours actually chewing. They spend all day just chewing. And, you know, and then they have to eat their own feces to recycle vitamin B12. And so what we've done is become much more efficient at that. And so, you know, as the climate changed 3 million years ago, whatever, 5 million years ago, started drying out the world. You know, the lush tropical land forests gave way to savannas, and the food supply changed, and the fauna changed. And so, you know, some of the animals changed, and humans, you know, the hominids, the ones that ran out of trees, either some of them did become plant-based. There were two species in particular, one called Paranthropus robustus and one called Paranthropus boisei, you know, nutcracker man. They developed these thick, powerful jaws to chew through twigs and stuff like that. But guess what? They went extinct because they could not continue to match the climate environment. But another set of hominids started to figure out how to scavenge for meat and then later to hunt. And this is the line we come from as human beings. And so, you know, probably, and again, this paper I talked about from Mickey Mandor suggests that this was the case for the human species, you know, mostly meat-based, mostly carnivorous. Sure, we would have grabbed a few berries here and there if we had opportunity. But again, depending on what part of the world you're in, that opportunity may or not have presented itself very often. But meat was always there. I mean, you, if you want to tell me we are plant-based or we had to eat plants, I'm going to say, well, which plant grows in every season in every part of the world? Name the plant. There's none. Maybe you might argue grass, but humans don't eat grass. But there's no magic berry that grows in, you know, northern Mongolia and in Argentina. I mean, there's just none. There's nothing that grows in the same place. Humans are the most, and this is interesting, of all species on the planet, humans are the most wide-ranging geographically. The next closest species that has as much of a geographic territory as humans are wolves. We have very similar diets because we can find what we need to eat in every single ecologic niche, every geological group. You know, I can find an animal in every single climate on Earth that humans have lived in. You know, if it's polar bears and seals up in the you know, on the North Pole, and, you know, everything in between. You know, and humans have managed to eat everything. We've eaten whales and sharks and every fish in the ocean, and lions and tigers and bears and even each other. I mean, we do, you know, humans are the most successful predator ever. So we have that clear capacity that's who we are. Now, about 80,000 years ago, we shifted our dietary patterns because those big animals, you know, the ratio of number of humans present versus number of mammoths available to hunt became very lopsided. And so all of a sudden we don't have these big fat animals that are easy to kill. I mean, elephants, believe it or not, if you have sharp weapon technology, are not that difficult to kill for a smart cooperative pack of humans, right? You know, because elephants look, you know, they look at a human and they're like, well, let's look at this little puny 150-pound thing. I'm 12,000 pounds. What's he going to do to me? I don't have a predator. Pull out the spear, you know, gig him a couple times and, you know, he's done. So we had that. And, you know, it was clear. And this is one of the reasons why elephants are still fairly prevalent in Africa, because they kind of co-evolved alongside early humans and it kind of started to see it coming. But once humans left Africa 1.5 million years ago as Homo erectus, and they headed into Southern Europe and across Asia, and then eventually across the Bering Strait down into North America, South America, and then eventually colonizing the Polynesian islands from Asia, we just wiped everything out in front of us because they didn't see it coming. These animals are just, it'd be like a bird flying there. And they're like, I'm not worried about a little bird. What's he going to do to me? And all of a sudden, spears come out, you know, and then eventually range technology comes out. So we've got this food supply we essentially effectively wipe out. I mean, I know there's some arguments about what killed the mammoths in North America. Maybe it's some great, you know, giant asteroid hit somewhere. But, I mean, evidence in Australia 50, 60,000 years ago and other places throughout the world, wherever humans showed up, within about 3,000 to 5,000 years, the megafaunal animals basically were wiped out because we ate them all. I mean, we ate them. We destroyed their habitat. We did things that ended up making the kill, because these animals, these big animals, don't reproduce very, very quickly. I mean, an elephant, you know, may only produce one elephant every handful of years, you know, and they only produce one or two in their lifetime. And so you kill off one, the replacement rate is not very high. And so it's very quick to make these species go extinct. So once that happens, we then say, well, crap, we ate all the big ones. Now we got these little puny ones left. Like, so let's go into the store and you eat all the good food first, and then you're left with the scraps, right? So now we're left with scraps as a population to eat. And so what we start doing, we start foraging for more plant material. We figure out how to process this stuff. We have to hunt smaller animals. You know, deers don't sit there. They're going to run. You know, whereas an elephant might just look at you and say, what are you doing, mofo? But the deer is going to sit there and run. So now you've got to develop atlatls and bow and arrows. And so the bow and arrow came into place around 80,000 years ago. And this is where we started doing that hunting. And so by necessity, we're eating leaner animals. We have less access to calories and overall fat content. So now we have to augment that with more plant food. And so then we're starting to eat, you know, scrounging for more tubers and roots and cooking some of them. And then eventually about, you know, arguably 10,000 years ago, give or take, you know, some regions more, some regions less, agriculture takes over. And with the onset of agriculture, in fact, probably as the animals were dwindling out, starting about 100,000 years ago, the human brain size actually started shrinking. So we peaked as human beings around 1,500 cc's. Now the average human brain size is around 1,300 cc's. So we actually lost about 200 cc's of brain size. We got smaller in stature because our nutrition just wasn't good. Remember, height, population height is a proxy measure for overall population nutrition. So when a population is very small, then they don't have high quality nutrition. And we see that throughout the world, the stunting, so-called stunting that we see. And so humans started to see that. Our bones got weaker. We were riddled with more disease. Teeth were bad. You know, you can talk to any anthropologist and look at this guy's a hunter-gatherer, this guy's a farmer. The farmers always have crappy bones. And it's just because of a dramatic shift in our food source as humans. And so, I mean, the good news was that having farms allowed humans to stay in one place. And because they can stay in one place, then they can build buildings. And now they can start to have relationships that result in civilization, and we can share knowledge. And then that shared knowledge led to further and further innovation. You know, and now we got people flying to Mars and stuff like that are going to be flying to Mars. And so that's been the good aspect of it. But at the same time, individual health has just continued to go down for 10,000 years and rapidly accelerated in the last, you know, arguably 50 years or 75 years since the advent of this ultra processed food and seeming to pick up speed with this continued push to let's get meat out of the diet and start eating, you know, fake crap. You know, that's just going to further devolve our species into, I mean, we're already in pretty sad shape. If you go outside and look around and, you know, you just can't imagine, can we get any worse? But I'm afraid there's, you know, I don't know if there's a limit on, you know, how pitiful we're going to get as a species. I don't know when we implode, perhaps before that.
I'm afraid to ask the question, how much worse can it get as far as health? But what are you seeing are the primary drivers, at least in the standard American diet? And you said the overly processing, is it wheat? Is it gluten in the wheat? Is it the oils? I mean, it seems like there's a consensus of one camp says sugar, one camp says oils as a primary driver. What have you found to be your opinion on this?
Yeah, I think all of it, quite honestly. I mean, I think, you know, I think let's think about it. If, you know, you and I were left to, you know, I'll give us a sharp hand axe or something like that. You know, let's say it's 50,000 years ago and we got minor technology and we've got a diet we've got to eat. There's only so much processing I can do to something, you know. I don't have machines and factories and chemical solvents and whatever else. I can't powderize my food. I can't make flour. These things that, I can't make protein powder. I mean, all these things. I mean, these things, you think about it, the way our digestive system is set up, you know, we're designed to chew food into smaller pieces, not powder. You know, you don't turn anything to powder in your mouth. I mean, unless you want to sit there and chew for 6 weeks, but you eat a piece of fruit or a piece of steak, you know, you're going to chew it up into a piece, maybe a centimeter in size or half inch and swallow it, right? This is what you do. Then your stomach takes over and then it further dissolves and, you know, breaks down some of the things. And then it goes into your small intestine and slowly it's absorbed and broken down very slowly in a very, you know, this, we have this 20 feet of intestine in small intestine or something, whatever it is. And it slowly winds its way through and there's certain hormones are triggered. There's incretin hormones, you know, at the top of your, you know, the top of the GI tract, there's GIP, gastric inhibitory peptide. Now I think it's been renamed glucose dependent insulinotropic, you know, peptide, but because it more accurately describes what it does. But and then it goes down farther, and then you start to hit things like GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide, and all these things in between. And there's supposed to be this very nice temporal pattern. And it's supposed to take a certain amount of time. That's designed for whole foods. That's designed for what we can chew. When you start dropping powder into there, you know, where the surface area is a million fold more accessible. The energy is more accessible. You're getting more energy. You're getting more calories out of the same amount of food, perhaps. You're having things that are being over flooded. You know, you can only absorb so much powder at a time because you've chewed it up and slowly digested. What happens is you just, you know, it just runs right through you. And there's a number of doors that these things can come out of, and when there's too many people coming through, they're just going to pass right through it. And so it runs through our guts, it irritates our guts, doesn't get absorbed, or it stimulates these hormones in a non-sequential temporal fashion. You get this metabolic dysregulation. You get insulin stimulated when it's not supposed to be, and glucagon, and so on and so forth. So you've got this mixture of just inappropriate food for the diet, and whether it's protein powder or refined flour, and these are the things maybe we're designed to eat, you know, perhaps. And now you start throwing in God knows what chemical stuff that we've put in there, you know, the preservatives and the fake colorings and the natural flavors, and which humans probably never really were designed to eat. Now you got to make it worse. And so now you have a gut that's unhealthy, it's unhappy, it's probably hyperpermeable. We get stuff getting through it's not supposed to. We get chronically inflamed. Inflamed tissue leads to insulin resistance, leads to perhaps obesity, leads to all these, you know, you name it, on the chronic disease. And so you've got this just mess of stuff caused by this, you know, modern diet, which is, you know, like I said, it's just a disaster. And, you know, I think for the end, the takeaway message here, and it's something everyone's heard, to stop eating processed food. And I mean, processed food is unfair to say because, you know, hamburger is processed food. It's been, what do you mean by process? What is processing defined? But we all know it's like pornography. I mean, we all know that walking in the store and buying, you know, a bag of Doritos is garbage. I mean, no one needs to tell you that. I mean, we know that. I mean, you could argue about what's in it and what ingredients are there, but I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not going to put, a tube of ground beef in the same category as, you know, a Doritos flavored cereal. You know, I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, you got the craziness out there. And so, but yeah, I mean, that's really the big issue in my view.
It's when you zoom out like that, it almost seems like none of the food, at least that are on the, have you seen the top 10 calories that are typically consumed by the standard American? It's like processed oils and cakes and cookies. And when you say it like that, it's almost, there's no remnants of food left in the general population. It's no wonder we're in this state.
Yeah. I mean, it shouldn't be a mystery to anyone. And I mean, it's almost like there's willful deceit to not address this. And, you know, we've seen this with this pandemic response where, you know, I mean, it's just laughable that we're just totally glossing over this. And the reason is, you know, it's financial, it's conflict of interest. I mean, there's too much. Our entire economy, in large part, depends upon a lot of these aspects. You know, from the agriculture production system, what we subsidize, you know, restaurants, you know, grocery stores, on and on and on, all these places that are relying on food. And then, of course, the illness is a result of that. I mean, the healthcare system, and we're, you know, $3.5 trillion a year in medical expenses. That's a big industry. There's people making money off that. And, you know, there wouldn't be that the need for that if we didn't have the food system we had and we weren't, producing this stuff, you know. And it's kind of obvious to me, and I think most people that look at it, but you know, most people are like, well, it tastes good, you know, it tastes good and I like it. So, oh well, I'm happy.
Instant gratification.
Yeah.
What movement are you creating with MeatRx? That's your company. Let's talk about that. Let's take it that direction. See if there is some hope left.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always hope. I mean, I'm optimistic. Otherwise I wouldn't be in public. I would just go hide off and go live on a ranch and not say anything to anybody and just live my life out quietly and, you know, eat a few cows and that'd be it. But I mean, no, I think, you know, my background was as a physician. I took an oath to help people and, you know, I'm doing it. I'm still doing that in just in a non-traditional way. And the fact that I'm not, you know, I'm no longer slicing people over and putting new knees in them, but I'm giving people new lives, I think. And so, you know, and I'd say that myself in this community that we now have that we've sort of helped to facilitate, you know, and so what we do at MeatRx is, you know, we just take people wherever they are. You know, we got a lot of people with all kinds of issues and we bring them in and we say, hey, look, we're here to help you any way we can. We want to support you. You know, of course, our underlying sort of baseline is to try to get people off the garbage and encourage them to eat, you know, more of a meat-based diet, you know, and again, generally, that's been very successful for the vast majority of people to do it. They get, you know, they generally improve. And unlike, you know, like I said, one of the problems with the healthcare system, it's not the fault of the doctors necessarily. I mean, there's some doctors that, you know, probably would be better served not to be doctors. But I mean, you know, it's really a system thing. I mean, medicine is very much a business. You know, it's you know, if you look at the growth of administrators in a hospital versus actual physicians over the last 20 years, administration has gone up something like 700%, where the number of doctors is pretty much flat, you know, very little change because of the need to continue to extract resources and, you know, profit out of that model. And it's not to the benefit of the patients. The patients get shortchanged. The doctors get shortchanged because they're just frustrated. It's fully the expectation that you're going to, if you get to see a patient every 15 minutes, that's a luxury. More often than not, you're going to be seeing two or three patients in those 15 minutes. And oh, by the way, you need to type in this computer for 5 of those minutes, and then you need to reconcile the billing, and you're going to spend 3 hours every night doing paperwork at the end of your day, and all your patients are going to be pissed off because you're staring at a computer the whole time, not even looking at them. This is the medical model, which I think it's hopelessly broken. The medical system is inextricably tied into the pharmaceutical industry, and those basically the pharmaceutical industry creates the curriculums and helps fund many of the medical schools, or at least in part. And so that's what we learn as physicians. You know, we learn the disease and we learn the drug that's used to treat the disease. And this is what's on the test. You know, how do you treat this disease? Well, you give them this drug. And, you know, and then you learn about the side effects of drugs and the different, you know, the different particular pharmaceutical properties and so on and so forth. And this is much of our medical education. So, and we're, you know, you're proud to be able to memorize all that stuff. You know, I can memorize more than everybody else. I get good grades and therefore I get to be the type of doctor I want to be. You know, it's very competitive. And I was very good at that. I mean, I got in one of the most competitive specialties there is, orthopedic surgeons. Orthopedic surgeons get paid more than anybody in the United States for what, doing what they do. And it's very competitive. And so you have to be able to memorize stuff. And I, you know, like I said, I did that, but at the same time, now I'm kind of like, well, wait a minute. You kind of put your critical thinking on hold while you do that. But back to, you know, with the medical system. And so, I think, you know, I don't know that you can fix it from the inside. I mean, I certainly take my hat off to those that try and try to do what they do, but you are limited significantly. There are, you know, there's a lot of brakes put on you. There's a lot of obstacles and roadblocks and time demands that are going to make you inefficient if your goal is to, you know, treat people with, you know, non pharmaceutical op means lifestyle and stuff like that. And so physicians aren't particularly good at that. And so I, you know, by, you know, sort of choice and, you know, partly by necessity, I, you know, figured out how to do that. And so we founded this company. And now we have, you know, literally thousands of people, and we take the time. We have people that, you know, here's a problem. You might have the best intentions in the world, and you might be very knowledgeable about lifestyle and nutrition as a physician, but you just don't have the actual physical means to facilitate that. You know, you can't spend, you know, an hour a day holding someone's hand for 3 months. You just can't do it. I mean, there's no way. You're lucky if you see the person 3 times a year for 15 minutes. And so what we are able to do, you know, from a community, and, you know, I had this thankful we have this scalability of internet. I literally spend an hour a day with the entire community, anybody wants to. And then there's meetings that happen all throughout the day, 24 hours a day, where people come in and get the support they need. And they're talking to people who are in a situation, similar situation. And it's just a, you know, I think a model that works very well for, you know, helping people make those changes. Because, you know, it's easy to hand somebody a flyer and say, hey, just do this. The compliance rate on that's going to be pretty low. I mean, or hey, watch this video just to go do it. It says the compliance rate is going to be real low. They're going to have questions. They're going to have support. They're going to have unique individual situations. They're going to have different unique problems that they can't solve or they need someone to help them with. And so this is where this massive continuous community support becomes so incredibly important to this. And then beyond this, the other thing, which is very exciting for me, is I continue to learn every day. So that is what excites me, because I'm learning more. I mean, I'm not going to say we don't have things to learn about how nutrition impacts people and how this diet in particular impacts people, because we're learning every day and we're finding things, and we're finding that some people, you know, maybe they're in a unique position where they respond this way. Maybe certain people with certain conditions respond better with this sort of nuance or shift. And so I think that's the next evolution. And as we scale this company to the next level, we're going to be, adding more of that and looking at, you know, some ways to, you know, figure out using data to figure out what's going to work more likely for more people.
I've been suggesting your company and health coaching for a long time. And from what I've seen, you guys have great results, and people need that. They need a community. They need continuous education that's constantly up for entropy. Like, people just forget, and then they fall back into their habits, and then they're not in a supportive community. But this is kind of delivering all of those things. You have the knowledge, the tools, the steps. You can create new patterns, create new emotional memories about food, relationships about food. So it's what I think really people do need. So I'm glad you're doing that. I mean, we're unfortunately winding down. I mean, I feel like we just touch the surface on this. I feel like we got to do a part two if we can do that later on. But
yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, we can do that down the road. Sure.
But so why don't you give everyone your social and their link and your links and how they can find you and your message, and that way we can share it on here.
Yeah. So again, you know, the first thing is, you know, meterx.com. Just, you can join for free, at least for a month. And I'm there every single day, 7 days a week. You know, it doesn't matter if it's Christmas, my birthday, whatever, July 4th. I'm there at 9 a.m. Pacific time every day. We have a meeting. You know, if you want to ask me questions directly, I'm happy to. We have new people in there every single day that I welcome, and we try to help them and support them. Other than that, my social media stuff, Instagram, I'm Sean Baker, SHAWNBAKER, 1967. I'm on Twitter at S Baker MD. I've got a YouTube channel, and I've just recently jumped in on TikTok, which I'm kind of laughing that I'm doing that. But I mean, it's been fun. I'm actually having some fun. I've been kind of goofy stuff. But my social media is really designed it's to get attention. You know, I mean, you know, I try to provide information and stuff like that, but just as much I might do some goofy stuff or some stuff that either makes people laugh or pisses people off. But the goal is to get an audience so that we can get this message out there. And this is why I do what I do. So some people, when they see me on social media, they have a certain perception. When then they talk to me, like, wait a minute, you're not a crazy guy. You're actually pretty down to earth and reasonable. But you know, like I said, I know how the game's played, or at least I think I do. And you know, it's one of those things where I think you have to entertain people before you can educate them. And so that's what I attempt to do with social media. And so, but yeah, that's where I'm at. Like I said, but MeterX is the best place to actually interact with me in a meaningful way. I prefer to talk to people face to face the best I can, you know, with the limitations of, you know, mass people. You know, I don't like typing messages in the, you know, Facebook comments. I think it's kind of goofy, and you lose nuance, and you lose, you know, a lot of the you know, you can't make a joke. You know, it's hard to type a joke and people get it. A lot of times they just don't. So, you know, anyway.
Yeah, all those keyboard warriors will be quick to swarm you with those jokes. Yep. This was awesome. I want people to hear about you, Animal Base. I've been talking about this since the first time I heard you. I think the first time I heard you was on Joe Rogan, probably about 2016 when you were on there. So just even firsthand, it's helped hundreds of my patients. And so thank you for doing what you do and putting out that message and creating this community. So I will continue to support that. And with that, thank you. And thank you for making the time.
Absolutely. Perfect. Well, let me know when you want to do part two. I'll be happy to know. Cause I can talk, I can talk 10 hours on this stuff. If we
yeah, right. We'll set a date soon.
All right.
Thanks, Doc. Appreciate that. Thank you all for listening for Vital Conversations. That was Dr. Sean Baker. He's a wealth of knowledge on nutrition, nutrition science, epidemiology, everything. And he's also hilarious. So join him on social media. Join his community if you're curious about your own health and want to get back to health. And with that, that is the end of this episode of Vital Conversations. Tune in next week, and we have some more great guests coming up for you. Boom.
This is Vital Conversations.